Everybody, I'm Marvin, I'm an alcoholic.
Take off your hat if you're going to introduce me.
All right. Now you go. Well, before I take it off then, 1310 Florida. Yeah, but the first thing I noticed about Keith and calling, talking, and making arrangements for him to be here was that he wanted to get to Dallas real early because he didn't want to get hung up in Dallas. When I picked him up yesterday at the airport, the first thing I noticed about he and Sue was they were on the phone, they were talking to sponsees, they were, this is what you do. Keith is telling you, get your butt to the meeting, you pick up your chip, you carry cake, it's your birthday. Celebrate, you know. So I know he's real involved in people's lives and recovery. For those, if you've been here this weekend, it's been a real treat to hear he and Sue share with their lives and how they've recovered. So I want to turn this over to Keith. Y'all make him welcome.
Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. Hi. Most important thing that I can share with you is that I've not taken a drink of alcohol, nor have I used any kind of narcotics since May 11, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. I'm glad to be here this weekend. Thank you all for inviting, and it's always a privilege to be able to participate in my recovery, and especially with my wife, Sue. Stand up, Sue. Some of the people haven't seen you. I want you to. We've been together 50 years, and so we're buddies. You think the steps are hard? Try the marriage vows. Till death do you part. There's been times when I wasn't sure if I loved her, and then I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay with her. But she doesn't believe in divorce. She believes in homicide. So. But she went lived with me for 15 years in my active disease, and if you can survive that, why, you're a keeper. She's Al-Anon. She's not an alcoholic, and she's worked for 50 years, pretty much. I think from in high school she had a job for 50 years, and she's an Al-Anon, so she's got all that money. She hid it. That's a lot of money. He had an average of about $50,000 a year. That's a keeper. There. Now she's got all my money. I'm a kept man. But I'm really, it feels good to do things like this weekend. It's a part of service, doing these things. What I am doing now is a part of service, of my program. And I believe service is gratitude in action. So I'm involved, and so is Sue. And our daughter, we have a daughter 46 years old, and she's very active in her program, Al-Anon, and sponsoring people, and has a home group. We have each one of us have a home group. Like this anniversary of 62 years, my home group's 48 years old. I didn't start it. It was there when I got there. There's a legacy. And I'm just a part of it, a member in good standing of my home group, and I haven't changed it. You know, I said, don't break a winning combination. So I haven't tried to change anything. I sponsor people. I have a sponsor. My sponsor is Three Fingers John. He's 52 years sober and 78 years old and 52 years sober. He says things like, when you're going through hell, don't stop. You know, real profound things like that, you know. He says, get in the boat and grab an oar. We don't need a captain. You know, profound things, little profound things. He makes me laugh, and that's what I love about him. He makes me laugh. He sees the humorous side. And I'll call him up, and before I can tell him I got a question or any kind of a problem or anything, he talks to me for about 20 minutes about all his problems. And then I forget what my problem was. And I thank him for sharing. But I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but when I had my first drink, an alcoholic was born. I was at a very early, young age when that happened. I was born and reared in the Texas-Oklahoma panhandle, no man's land, out in kind of no man's land there. And it was county option. The Baptists bought the liquor license when they came up so often. So it was county option. So you'd have to go from one place to another. You'd have to drive in some place, drive a long ways to be able to get any beer or anything. But there was always homebrew and White Lightning and moonshine. And I guarantee you, when you drank that White Lightning or that moonshine, there was no umbrellas or pieces of cantaloupe or anything floating in it. Might be some dead flies or bugs and some straw, but boy, I tell you what, that got you downtown right now. I'm telling you, downtown, downtown. And my folks used to make what they call, I'm at least a fifth generation alcoholic, so I'm not bragging about it other than the fact that if you needed to drink growing up in an alcoholic home, that's a good place. And they made what they call purple passion. And they'd take a 5-gallon pickle crock and they'd fill it up 3/4 full of White Lightning. And then they'd pour a big old bottle of Morgan David wine on that. And then they'd put a quarter Everclear. And then they'd fill it up with Welch's grape juice. And they had an old steel ladle, and they had tin cups. You drank that stuff with a tin cup. And I'll tell you what, about 3 cups, and it released you of all your inhibitions. You could tell people exactly what you thought of them. I seen a guy drink it. It was in a 2-story apartment. I don't know how many steps it was down to the floor, but this guy drank 3 cups, went out, missed the first step, fell all the way down, got up and brushed himself off, and went on down the road. And a guy was restoring a piano in a garage across the street. He came over one Saturday afternoon, drank 3 cups of Purple Passion, went over there and took a sledgehammer and beat that piano plumb into the ground. You'd see people come over and drink, and they'd leave, and you might see them the next day or so coming down the street. They'd be coming down towards you, and they'd go clear across the street and go on the other side. You could smell it a mile away, and you drink enough of it, it's coming out of you for a long time. And but it got the job done. You drank that stuff for effect, I can guarantee you. And I think they probably put a little that stuff in my baby bottle, But I remember when I was a little kid, 7 years old, and my mama died when I was born, and my daddy's folks reared me, and my daddy went off to war, and I was being raised by my grandma and grandpa. My grandpa was a drunk. He was a drunk, town drunk, drunk all the time. And he got with his buddy named Slicker Jim, and they got an old 1934 Ford coupe, and I was 7 years old, and they had a jug of corn whiskey, and they pulled the top of the cork out and threw it away, and my job was to hold that jug of corn whiskey and sit in the front seat of that 34 Ford. And they went around out back then in the early 40s. The oil companies were sending these guys out to buy mineral rights from the farmers. The farmers didn't know there was any oil there or anything, and they'd go out and get the farmer drunk and get him to sign these papers and sell the mineral rights. And so my grandpappy and Slicker was in this 34 Ford. I got this jug of corn whiskey sitting in my legs, and we take off. And somewhere in the middle of the morning, whatever, they're all drunk. Everybody's drunk, and they come off an old road and hit a blacktop road headed to town. And I got this jug of corn whiskey. The cork's gone. I probably stuck my tongue in there to keep it, bouncing a little. I was sipping on it probably, I don't know. I knew I was in trouble because Grandpappy is drunk and Grandma's going to whip all of us. And they took off in that old 34 Ford and headed north into a north wind. And an old 34 Ford, it run 35 mile an hour in third gear and 35 mile an hour in second gear. And they got that baby going, and my grandpa made a near-fatal mistake. The door was ajar, and he opened that door, and the door on 34 Ford Coupe's a suicide door, and the wind blowing, and when he opened that door, bam, he was gone. The door slammed shut, and we was 4 miles down the road for it. I got to tell Slicker to stop the car. And we turn around and go back, and the old man's drunk out there. He's skinned up from one end to the other. It's Saturday afternoon, and the people are going to town on the farm to market road. And I'm a little old kid holding that jug of corn whiskey. And I'm in trouble. They're drunk. And now I'm seeing all the kids I know, you know, from the community. And I'm embarrassed. And Grandpappy lost his teeth and his glasses. And he's skinned up and tore up. And pretty soon they said, give the old man a drink. So he takes a drink, and then Slicker took a drink, and he said, give the kid a drink, and I took a drink. And I'm standing there. I'm scared to death. I'm embarrassed. I just have all those feelings that are just all terrible and shame. And then he said, the old man, take a drink, and poured some of that on his hand, slapped his face, and Slicker took a drink, and give a kid a drink. I took a drink. I tell you what, about two or three drinks out of that jug of corn whiskey, I didn't care if that old man lived or died. I didn't care what anybody said or thought or saw. 7 years old, standing alongside of the road, alcohol did for me exactly what I wanted it to do. I didn't stay drunk from the time I was 7 years old till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I tried to. I searched madly for that feeling again and again and again. And that's the story of my life. Growing up in an alcoholic home, and at least being a fifth-generation alcoholic, all the character defects of all the other alcoholics. You read the stories in the book, there's different people in the book, different stories, types of alcoholics. And in my family, I got all these other drunks' character defects. I became the family's best, worst example. And those character defects all rolled downhill into me. I got them all. And I took off right away, and I got in trouble. I was locked up in 1952. I was locked up in a penitentiary. It wasn't a big penitentiary, but it had barbed wire around it, and it was all young men in there. And I was locked up because I was driving a car, drunk, and ran over somebody, and there was bodily injury. And I left the scene of the accident. So in 1952, I was locked up. From 1952 until 1955, I was locked up with just a young man in a penitentiary. And that didn't hurt me a bit. It was actually good. It taught me some discipline. And I learned a lot of things. I learned how to survive. I learned that it don't make no difference whether you're pitching or catching, you're still playing ball. You'll get that in a minute. And I just survived there, and I functioned there. And I got out of there and did what I was supposed to do, started drinking, and I got married. My grandma told me it don't take no more effort to marry a rich woman than it does a poor woman. And she just didn't tell me it took more effort to keep a rich woman. And I married this little gal. Her dad's one of the 10 richest men in the United States. He had a lot of money. And I sweet-talked her and married her, and that marriage lasted 9 months. And I was arrested in Fort Worth, Texas, for transporting some outside issues. And I was locked up, and my father-in-law came to see me, and he said, I got a lot of money. And I said, I know that. And he said, the reason I have a lot of money is I don't make bad investments, and you're a bad investment. And so they annulled me, I was sentenced to 3 to 5 years in Huntsville Penitentiary in Texas, and I went off again. One more time, I went off again, and I did my time. When I got out of there, I went back home, which is up in the panhandle of Texas, and my friends picked me up at the gate, and I went to a country dance, a dance on Saturday night. I got out of there, and I went to dance, and it was kind of boring, and I wanted everybody to know I was back in town, so I started to fight. And the fight got out of hand, and so I ducked into the woman's restroom. I may be sick, but I'm not stupid. And so I ducked into a woman's restroom, and as I went into a woman's restroom, there's a lady standing at the door, and I said, tell me when the fight's over. She said, okay, and I went into a woman's restroom and hid, and pretty soon she stuck her head in there and said, "You can come out now, the fight's over and the band's playing." And I came out and I asked her for a dance, and I'm a quick study. In one quick dance, I found out she had a car, a job, money in the bank, driver's license, place to stay, none of which did I have, and that was 50 years ago, and it was Sue standing at that door. So, I'm a violent drunk, physically violent. I'm a physically violent drunk. That comes from fear, I suppose. Some people hunker down with fear. Other people drive fear like a fast car, and I drove fear like a fast car, and I was going all the time, doing something all the time. And she liked the excitement of that, and she started running with me. We dated for 2 weeks, and the people in that local town nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. And it was so sick. It was so sick and so sick that it had to be love. It just had to be. Couldn't have been nothing else. And we just beat the heck out of each other and then go make love. It was just... we call it foreplay. I mean, really, it was really violent, very violent. If you try to get in between us, we'd beat the hell out of you and then go have sex. One of the most important things about our marriage for 50 years is that we've always had good sex, even today. We hit it off and we went along, and she had a job and I was just running and gunning around hustling. I'm a hustler. I like the deal. I don't care if it's 50 cents or 50 million. Deal me in, baby. I'm in the deal. And I was hustling, and she showed up pregnant. And I don't remember that. I must have been crossing over the invisible line when we did that. I don't remember having that discussion about family. But she said it was me, and I said, "Okay, I'll marry you. I love you." So, yeah. So we got married, and it was just a catastrophe. It was just an experience because I was drunk, and every preacher was drunk. Everybody's drunk. But we got married, and we had a piece of paper, and we got a little apartment. And, I tried to do the right thing. I would try to do the right thing. I mean, I'd see people, and I'd mock them. I'd try to do the right thing. But I just drank and ran, running and gunning all the time, and I was just, I don't know anything about being a husband or a father. And the more I did this, now we're married, and she's pregnant, and she's going through all that. Her mother came over one time. Her mother was a dog catcher in that town. And so she came over to the house one day, and Sue was all tore up, and she's pregnant, and so she's going to commit suicide. And she fixed a big pot of chili so I'd have something to eat after she was gone. She didn't want me to be hungry. And I had a beer and some cornbread and a big bowl of chili, and I sat down because she's going to commit suicide. And she didn't cut her wrist right. She just kind of cut it there and then held it over a white paper tablecloth, and worked her wrist so I'd get some drops of blood to fall on the tablecloth. And it looks like you're really bleeding. But I figure it's going to take her about a week to bleed out. And her mother came up said, "What's going on?" I said, "Well, you might as well get a bowl of chili and sit down and have a beer because Sue's going to commit suicide and she's not bleeding very fast." And her mother threw her chili all over me and we had a big fight. And me and Sue threw her mother out and she didn't come back for a year and a half. That's the way it was. It's just that way all the time. We finally had to move, take a geographic move and see if we can't get something going on. I was the same. We'd move, I'd get a new bunch of guys. I'm a leader. I always had a bunch of, bent fenders following me around and doing things, always hustling, always doing the hustle. We had a little girl, and she's home with a little girl, and I'm, in jail, out of jail. I'm trying to go to school or something, anything but work. I don't like work. I can watch you work forever. I don't like work. I'm a thief, really, is what I am. And I don't know if I'm a good thief or not, but I don't have much guilt. When I get caught, I don't have much guilt. I have to figure out what to do to get out of trouble, so I don't have guilt very long because you got to be thinking what to do to get out of trouble. And so I was just hustling and got a job and okay, you got to work, you got a family, you got to work. And so we're in Oklahoma, and my friend named Lion Shorty said he could get me a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach, California. That's ocean. But, I mean, a guy named Lion Shorty wouldn't lie to you, would he? I mean, come on. So we loaded up all our stuff, and the dog and the cat and the kid and an old station wagon, got a trailer, piled all our stuff, looked like the grapes of wrath, and we headed west. It took me 30 days to get there. Most people can do it in 3, but I was lost a lot. She said, why don't you ask somebody where we are? And I said, I don't want them to know I'm lost. We got to California. I had a drunken uncle got me a house, a deal on a house to move into. Nobody lived into it. There was a bunch of hippies lived on one side and a motorcycle gang on the other side. Just perfect. Got a deal on that baby. And moved right in. The hippies come over. I'd lost all my friends and left them back in Oklahoma and Texas. And these hippies doing some different stuff. I'm telling you, I never seen nothing like that. They'd take that acid, take your clothes off and lay naked in the front yard and watch the sun come up and go down. But I'm a joiner. Met two friends over there, Doc and Professor. Yeah. Motorcycle gang on the other side, you know. And I just met a bunch of new guys and started my deal all over again. I'd go off and I'd come home and bring all my friends with me. You know, they're the guys that don't want to go home and fight with their wives, so they come over and watch me fight with mine. She took up carrying a 12-inch butcher knife, and she's waving this butcher knife around all the time. I like guns myself. I had a .44 Magnum with a 2-inch barrel, and I'd pop a cap in your ear. You'd pay attention to me. You couldn't hear nothing, but you'd pay attention to me. She'd stick that knife right in my stomach, and I'd stick the barrel of that .44 Mag right on her nose, and she'd say, you go first. I said, you're crazy. If I shoot you, you're dead. She said, I know. When that big old bullet hits me, it'll knock me back, and the knife will go forward, and you'll die too. You know, sick women don't need to train for that. They intuitively. I came home one time and passed out on my stomach 15 minutes into a two-hour discussion with her, and they don't like that. And so she took that butcher knife. I had an old shirt on. She took that butcher knife and stabbed me all over my back with that butcher knife. It wasn't sharp. I wasn't stupid. It wasn't sharp. And I woke up and said, man, something's wrong with my back. And she said, oh, let me see. She peeled that old shirt off my back and said, you broke out of acne in the back drinking that rock gut whiskey. She said, let me get to rubbing alcohol and fix you up. And, oh, yeah. That'll get you closer to Jesus than anything them church people will, I tell you what. She used to beat the heck out of me all the time. I'd be drunk, couldn't stand up, and she'd hit me with her high heel shoes, and she wore them heels off them little high heel shoes and little spike high heel shoes, and there'd be a little round thing with a little wire in there to support that little piece of, and when it hits you, it's a funny looking little mark. And I have all these whaps all over my head, and then she'd claw me and scratch me and kick me in the balls, and it's hard to tell your friends that you've been fighting with 3 of the meanest guys you ever seen in your life, and you fell into a bush and got all scratched up. And them ain't hickeys, them are bite marks, baby, let me tell you. And every time we had a fight, I fought for my life. I really did. And it was just constantly. And I ended up in front of a judge, and the judge talking to me about me, and he had the right guy, and he had all my stuff there. And he said, yeah, I need to send you up, lock you up. You need to be locked up. And there was some people with the court system there that had something to do with AA, and they said, well, maybe try AA. I didn't know what AA was. I'd been doing B&B myself. But I knew some people in jail, and I owed them money, so I didn't want to go there. So I'm going to go over here and, hey, whatever it is. I had an old guy named Ivan Miller come and get me. Ivan was sober about 20 years, and he was a machinist, and he kept dropping things off that lathe, and he held on to them, so his arms was almost down to his, had real long arms. He looked droopy little old guy. I'm looking at him, I think, Jesus, he looks like he's drunk today. And Ivan said, come on. And the judge said, go with him. And so I went out and got in his old truck, and he took me over to this church, said there's AA there, okay, and he took me home. Now, I'd been in a fight, and I was doing real good until this guy that I was fighting with, brother, hit me with a 12-inch crescent wrench upside the head, a duck, but he almost knocked my ear off, so they had to sew my ear back on. And I had this big blood-soaked earmuff around my head, a big old turban around my head, and I had a long beard, long hair. Had a pair of cut-off Levi's, no underwear, no socks, no shoes, no identification. I was traveling pretty light, really. So they sent me home. Ivan took me home. I laid down on the couch and bled out, and my earmuff stuck to the couch. I'm laying there. The dog and cat's looking at me funny. My dog, I tell you what, I'm terrible. Everybody suffers when I'm suffering. I'm going to tell you, my dog had chewed all the hair off his body. He looked like, everywhere his mouth had reached, he looked like one of them hyenas. And he had a dry mouth, and he had a permanent, his lip stuck up, had a twitch. The cat had a permanent puff tail. My kid looked like a wounded animal. She had hair in her face, an old coat on with old rotten Easter eggs down in the lining. Sue wore one of them beehive hairdos with a can and a half of spray net in it, you know, big old tall thing. I lit a cigar next to her one time. She had all that spray net in there, and she went, poof. And she just turned blue. I had to throw my coat over. The family wagon was an old baby poop brown Pinto. Didn't have no reverse in it. Went down the road crooked. Had a hole in the muffler. The dog and the cat would get in the back of that old station wagon with the kid, and they'd shed, and so there was dog lick and hair all over the windows in that old Pinto. The window on the driver's side was half down, half up, and Sue's hair always blew out. That was their work car. You had to come up through the neighbor's yard and be sure you don't run over a hippie and park over there so you could drive out. And no reverse in it. And so I'm laying on the couch. She went to see a new lawyer. He told her I should go to AA, so she came home with a new solution. I didn't tell her I had a court card. She walked in the door and said, I know what you need to do. You need to go to AA. I said, I thought it'd come to that. And I found a man in AA, and I was supposed to go to a meeting tonight at 8 o'clock, 8:30. So, okay. So she tried to fix some food. About 8 o'clock, she came over with that butcher knife and said, get up. I said, I don't think I'm going. She said, yeah, you're going. She jabbed me with that butcher knife. Said, we're going to that AA meeting. So we go out of our house. Now, let me give you this picture. My house is painted four different colors because I lost interest easy. You know? Had good intentions, but I lost interest easy. And it wasn't a big, you know, it was just a light green and a brown and a little, you know, a mix. Sometimes I'd mix a whole bunch of paint together and we'd paint one end of the house. Every door in the house was off the hinges because I'd run through them. And got that old Pinto out there. My yard, I didn't have a front yard. I had front dirt. I was mowing my front dirt and my mower died, so I blowed a hole in it. Just like, you know, a horse breaks his leg, you shoot him. I shot my lawnmower right in the front yard. And we go out and get in the old Pinto. Got the dog and the cat and the kid in the old Pinto. I got this big blood-soaked ear muff on. Sue's got this big Leaning Tower of Pizza. We get in the old Pinto, and we go over to the AA meeting, church. We pull up out like there, and you could look in. I looked in there and seen all the people in there, and I thought, well, I've sunk to the bottom now. If my friends see me going in that meeting, they'll never have nothing to do with me again. That's called low-bottom snobbery. Low-bottom snobbery, baby. When you come before I come and I pull up and I'm afraid my friends are going to see me because they're going to see me going in there and doing something about this deal, see? And so she jabbed me with that butcher knife. She said, what time's the meeting over? And I said, it's over at 10. She said, I'm going to tell you something, Ace. If your ass comes out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you. Now, you can keep me in AA meeting. You got a crazy woman with a 12-inch butcher knife circling the perimeter out there. I may be sick, but I ain't stupid. I'm not going out there before 10. And I went in there and counted the squares in the ceiling, how many light bulbs was out. I knew who the old-timers were. They had hair growing out of their ears. I know that. That's wisdom. Don't want nothing to do with them. I'm sitting in there with this blood-soaked earmuff on. I'm tore up, ripped up, and I didn't hear nothing. And every Monday for, I don't know, 6 weeks or more. I would sit at that house all week, and Monday she'd load up in that old car and take me over. There was an Al-Anon meeting right next door, but there wasn't nothing wrong with her. And I went to that AA meeting. I didn't drink. I didn't use nothing. I was so dry as a fire hazard. I was just ready to implode. And she said, you can go by yourself. I beat the deal down at the courthouse. And she said, you can go by yourself. And I drove by that meeting, and an old-timer standing out front, and I stopped, and I said, I'm not coming back here no more. He said, you must be going to B&B. And I said, what's that? He said, I don't know, but where you're going, it ain't AA. And he wasn't kidding, because I got drunk right away, because I wanted to drink, and I got drunk. And I'm going to tell you, it never gets better. It always gets worse. And then it gets worser. And I'd go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous drunk, drink a bunch of coffee and try to sober up in the meeting. Sometimes I'd go to meetings sober and I'd get up and go outside and get drunk. I came out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came out of blackout in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting once. That's scary. I would have left, but I didn't know who brought me, you know. Terrible. And I know what it's like to go home after an AA meeting, and I tell her, you know, look, I know I can't fight with you anymore. I can't do this. I can't do that. And she'd say, I need some money, and then we'd have a big fight, and then I'm off out there drunk again. I'd go back to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. They'd say, you know, you got to take care of business, this and that and the other. I'd go home. She'd say, I need some money. I said, I'll give you a check. She didn't want none of my checks. She went to jail for my checks. And we'd have a big fight, and I'd be downtown and drunk again, back in jail. She'd have to come bail me out. That was her job, you know. She had to bail me out, sometimes two or three times in one day. And I'd go honk and sniff on the girls and go home and say, get in the bedroom, I'm horny. She'd say, you ain't made love to me in years, you stinking old drunk. And I'd say, well, it seems to me like you enjoyed it a little bit. And then we'd have a fight over who was whose Laura companion, and I'd have to go out and go downtown with the ladies that understood me and get drunk again. You see, the same me will always drink. And even though I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was going back to a drunken home, a crazy home, back in an environment where there was no program, no change. And all those old things would go off again, and I'd be drunk again and again and again. And I did that for from early 1970 until 1976. And in and out, in and out. I didn't cause any big disruptions or anything like that, but I tried everything. I joined everything I could, everything. And I just couldn't stop drinking. I didn't know I had a phenomena craving. I did not know. I know what it's like to stand in my kitchen, and I look down a hallway. I got a bottle of vodka in my hand. I look down a hallway. A little 9-year-old girl stands at the end of that hallway. She's got her chin on her chest and her hair's in her face. And I turn around and take a drink, not because I was ashamed. Heck, I'll take you way past shame, baby. You stick with me. Well, I'll take you way past shame. But because I needed a drink, when I looked back, she'd be gone. She just wanted to know which direction I was going, so she'd go the other way. I know what it's like to crawl out of the back of my house, drunk, lip-dragging drunk. And the only money that is in that house was in my daughter's piggy bank. And I'd crawl hands and knees down the hallway, reach underneath her bed, drag her piggy bank out and bust it. And a big time Charlie like me, I'm separating the pennies, nickels, dimes, quarter, because I ain't going to be taking nothing but silver when I go to the liquor store. And I look over my shoulder and a little 10-year-old girl's hiding in the closet watching me steal her money. And being the very best father I could be, I let her shoot out behind me without inflicting any more pain in her life. I know what it's like to stand in my bathroom and I'm putting that stuff in me, because one thing don't work, I move right on to the next one. I'm not a specialist. I'm a pig. The only thing I've never had is a pap smear. Did it all. And standing in my bathroom looking in a mirror, I look in a mirror, and just for a second I see the eyes of a little 10-year-old girl looking through a hole in the door in the bathroom where I probably stuck my foot. And her eyes met mine in that mirror, and I knew it was wrong. What was going on was wrong. There's something screaming inside of me. Something screaming inside of me. Not a word coming out of my mouth, but it's screaming so loud in my ears. I don't want to be this way. Don't you understand? I don't want to live this way. I don't know why I have to live this way. I did not understand the phenomenon of craving. And I'd turn around, do my thing, and she'd be gone. I lived like that, not one day, not one week, not one month. We lived like that for a number of years. And finally, December 1975, I went on my last run, and I ended up locked up in an old motel room. And I made a call to Alcoholics Anonymous one more time, because if you don't die, you're going to have to come back to AA. Back to AA, and I had to come back to AA again. And I made a 12-step call. It was a call central office, and a little guy named Little Jack came over to my house, and he did a typical 12-step call on me. It took him a few hours to get me in a place, and he 12-stepped my wife and daughter and said, they need help, and Little Jack took me to a detox. They locked me up in a detox. 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 Nothing. I said, how about some hard candy and Valium? No. Detox. Eat a banana. You need potassium. Put a banana in your mouth and shut up. You have nothing to say. You know, an idiot's been running your life. And I said, who? Who? He said, you. And I'd take three steps and laugh and three steps and cry. There was 39 of us in this detox. It's a brand new detox. And I didn't know if I was Frank or Ernest or walking or riding a bicycle. I didn't know. I was coming out of it, and I detoxed. And 11 days in there, I detoxed again. I kicked again. I mean, it just seemed like everything I'd been putting in me just had to come out. And it was just a terrible, terrible time. I don't ever want to drink again, just on the fact I don't want to detox again. I've had some bad, embarrassing moments in my drinking, but I don't want to detox again. Thank you very much. And people from hospital institution came into this detox, and you had to have a sponsor. And I asked this guy to be my sponsor. His name's Rotten Ron. Rotten Ron was rotten. He was 9 years sober, and he was rotten, mean, rotten, vile little sucker. But he was AA to the core. Little guy. He'd get up in my face. He said, you need a sponsor, and I'm it. I said, I don't like you. He said, I hate you. He said, it's not necessary to like your sponsor. I said, I thought a sponsor is supposed to be a friend. He said, if you want a friend, get a dog. And he said, I'll be back and pick you up. And he'd come and get me, take me to meetings. He had an old box van, had a bunch of milk crates, plastic milk crates in the back. He come and got me. Me and a bunch of other newcomers said, grab a crate, hold on. He'd take off, go down the street, hit a light, all of us would slide to the front. I remember one time I said, you know, I beat a man to death with my bare hands for less than what you're doing to me. And he took off, and we all slid to the back, and some 300-pound newcomer fell on top of me, and I'm crying. I said, Jesus. Pulled up in front of my house. He said, go in there and shut up and don't tell her what's wrong with her, and I'll be back and get you. I said, what do you mean don't tell her what's wrong? I said, don't tell her what's wrong with her. I said, well, who's going to tell her what's wrong with her? Somebody's got to tell her what's wrong. I said, I don't know. It ain't going to be you. Shut up. So I went in the house. I went up the door and knocked on the door. She come to the door. I said, I got to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do? She said, oh, I've been going to Al-Anon, the kid's been going to Al-Teen, the dog's going to Al-Dog, and the cat's going to Al-Cat. And we released you. And they did. They released me. And my sponsor would come and get me in that old van. I'd go out and grab a crate, and away we'd go. Go to meetings. I was crazy. I was crazy. And I'd sit in the meeting, and my chair would just scoot all around. I might end up clear over there. Couldn't sleep. Lay awake at night. Drinking, I don't know how much, terrible amount of coffee. Going out afterwards and eating a piece of pie. I go in a restaurant. I said, how much is a piece of pie? $3. How much is the whole pie? $5. Bring me a pie and a spoon. You know, I'm eating sugar. Meeting sugar and a low maintenance diet just don't cut it, baby. I'll tell you what, I was just crazy. Sober and crazy. Trying to work the steps. They told me how to work the steps, and I'd try to do the steps. I just crazy. I had all kinds of flying apart. had to get a job that was supposed to do something to make some money. I didn't know. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't think. And I had people after me. Really after me. If I got what I deserve, you better not be sitting next to me, baby. I'll guarantee it's going to splatter. I worked the steps. I do an immoral inventory, a fearful inventory, and I give it to them. Here. There. I'd jump up on my chair when I shared in the meeting and jump up and down and scream and yell and let the demons out. Yeah. People just looking, well, it's crazy. I love the old timers that have the ability to wait till you're just about ready to implode. You're just about ready to implode. You're sober. I've set up the chair. I've put this down. I've been the secretary. I've been this. I've read the book. I've worked the steps. I'm just sober. And I was standing in a meeting, and I looked around, and here's this guy come up next to me. He wasn't short enough to be a midget or tall enough to be a man. Funny-looking guy. Had a welder's hat pulled down over his ear. Had hair sticking out everywhere. Had a pair of thongs on, and he painted his feet black with shoe polish like he had socks on. He said, I don't like to do laundry. I seen him in the meeting the night before, and he was a treasurer, and he stood up and gave a treasurer's report. He said, I stole all the money, and I ain't giving it back. And the group said, you got to keep doing it until you get it right. And here he is standing next to me. I said, what do you want? He said, will you be my sponsor? Oh, jeez. I know I really made God mad, you know what I mean? Come on. I went over to my sponsor. He stood in the corner all the time. When newcomers would come in, he'd tell him, look at that guy over there, Keith. You see him? You keep going in and out, you're going to end up like him. I was the group's best, worst example. And this guy come up and asked me to be his sponsor. I didn't know what to do. I went over to my sponsor. I said, see that guy over there? He said, yeah. I said, he asked me to be a sponsor. And my sponsor said, yeah, I know. I sent him over. Oh. What am I supposed to do? He said, you go back over there and do whatever he says. That don't make sense to me today. I didn't want to argue with my sponsor because they get crazy and spit all over you. I went back over and said, my sponsor says I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? He said, I ain't got a car, I need a ride home. By then, I was sober long enough to have an AA car, you know. Park it out in front of the meeting hall. People said, how you doing? Well, look at my car. Had a Mark IV Lincoln, had a hood longer than a whore's dream. Great big old long Lincoln. Had a license plate, personalized AA car. That's how I'm doing. Get in the car. I got him in that car. He started telling me all this sick, crazy stuff. Sick stuff. And then he said, you ever do anything like that? I said, yeah, sure. I started telling him some of my stuff. And he said, whoa, dude, you're really sick. We need to go to a meeting. Now, we're going to a meeting. I'd take him home, let him out. I said, I'll come back and get you. I come back and get you. His hair is all strung out. I said, why don't you comb your hair? He said, I did. Oh, okay, get in the car. He said, how about this? Did you ever do this? And he started telling me some sick stuff. I had to lie to him. You can't let them one-up you, you know. Next day, I picked him up, and he said, I know what you told me last night you did was a lie. I said, how you know that? He said, because it's physically impossible to do that. I tried it. We went to a meeting here. This guy talked a lot about God. We went to hear him, and we're sitting out in the car, and he said, we need a miracle. We need help. I said, yeah, how's that? He said, we need a sign like a burning bush or parting of the water, something. I'm thinking if I had some lighter fluid, I'd torch a hedge over here, but... You want a sign? Yeah, okay. So I reached in the glove box. I had a .45 automatic in the glove box. I run around in it, stuck it upside his head, and pushed on it real hard. And I said, I'm going to count to 10, you pray. And if I don't have a floating resentment and decide to pop a cap on you, you've done step 3. I count along. He's mumbling along. Pretty soon he jumped up, ran out of my car and went in there and rat-finked to my sponsor, showed him that ring on the side of his head and told my sponsor I put that gun to his head and made him do step 3. And my sponsor said, yeah, ain't he spiritual? You can laugh it off, but me and him are both still sober. He showed up at the front door of my house. I'd moved out of the old house. Prosperity was coming along, and I got a new house. And he showed up, knocked on the front door. I went to the door. There he stood. He had his old car parked in my new driveway. All running down my new driveway. His old car had stickers all over. He looked like he had one foot in the concrete and the other half of him, he's going to Tijuana. He had a big book with paper sticking in it, and he's standing at my front door. I said, "What do you want?" He said, "I want to work the steps like you did." I'm trying to remember how I did them. I said, "Well, come on in. I'm powerless. My life's going to be unmanageable for a while because you're going to be in my house. You're crazy and I'm crazy and we understand each other. Come on in here and we'll do step three." He said, "You're not going to get my gun on my head anymore." I said, "No, we're going to get down on our hands and knees and do that third step prayer." So we got in the kitchen, got down on our knees, and he cuddled up on her neck next to me, and we did that third step prayer. He cuddled up underneath my arm. I had that tingling sensation and questioned my sexuality there for a minute. Cat walked by and looked at us silly. Got up and he took a bunch of blank paper out of his book and threw it at me and a pencil. He said, "Here, I can't read or write, so here's a pencil. I'll talk and you write." And he started talking and I started writing. And pretty soon he said, "Did you ever do anything like that?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd done my fourth and fifth step. You know, more was being revealed. And I may be sick, but I ain't stupid. You know, we invited God in this room and he can't read or write. I'll just put some of my stuff in his." So I just put some of my stuff. Yeah, God don't care, man. When he sends the trash barrel, put your junk in it. Get it out and let go of it. Yeah, you betcha. And that guy, we got through that deal, he jumped up and kissed me and said, "I love you," and ran out in the front yard in front of God and everybody and the neighbors and said, "I love you," and jumped in his old car and down the street he went. And standing in my front yard, it went from the head to the heart. It went from the head to the heart. It made full circle. Standing in my front yard that day, it made full circle. And that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't look for something that isn't here. Don't look for something in here. The magic of Alcoholics Anonymous is one drunk helping another drunk. One drunk helping another drunk. That guy told me a story about his little girl coming home one day and from school, and he was sober a little while, and he said his little girl came home, crawled up in his lap, and she had one of them little paper flowers she'd cut out. And she opened it up and said, "Daddy, here, I want to give you a flower that'll never die." And I shared a situation with him about my daughter. I was sober. My daughter wanted me to come and do something with her, and I was able to go do it and stand in the back of the room. And my daughter wanted to be a model, and she enrolled in a modeling class, and she was graduating, a little girl. She came out on the stage and waved at her daddy in the back, leaning against the wall back there. And I had daddy tears. Not tears of sorrow, tears of joy. And sitting in that kitchen that day, me and that guy shared those experiences that we had. We knew what would be going on if we were drunk and these kids were around us. But we had gratitude for sobriety. Now, I'm the kind of guy, if you would have told me your daughter gave you a flower and I'm drinking next time I seen you, I'd say, "Here comes the flower guy." I would have made fun of you. But sitting in my kitchen that day, sharing those stories about our daughters, we shared tears of joy and gratitude, and it touched my heart. And I started to change. I had a lot of problems. I owed a lot of money when I sobered up, and I had to pay it back. And it took me 14 years of sobriety to pay the money back. I wasn't excited about that, but I wanted to pay it back, and I did. And I share that simply because of the fact that by the time I worked and got better jobs and made more money and did that things to pay that financial amends, my standard of living at 14 years sober was much higher than it would have been had I not worked and just blown it off, I'm sure. And I had to learn how to be a husband, and I had to learn how to be a father. And there was many times that it was hard to, because I had the guilt of the way I treated my family. But the old timers told me that I had to make a living amends. And I remember one time my daughter lied to me, and I was going to have to punish her. I was going to have to ground her. My sponsor always said, don't inflict a punishment on your child that's more of a punishment on you than it is the child. And so I grounded her, and she had some things she wanted to do, and she cried all night about that. And I held my mind. I took her to school the next morning and said, "You're grounded tonight. You have to come home from school." And I pulled up in front of that schoolhouse. She said, "Daddy, I can go in here and get some drugs. You know, them boys have drugs, and I can go get some drugs and make it a little easier to get through today." And I remember looking at her, and I said, "God, you better give me the words, because we're at the fork in the road." And I said, "Baby, let me tell you something. You remember when I did that stuff? You saw me doing that stuff, and you know how much you hated me, and you know where it took me. And if you go in that schoolhouse, you make the decision to take those drugs, it's your choice. But we have a sober home, so you can't come home. Don't come home if you get loaded. And remember where it took me, that's where you're going." And that's all I had to share with my daughter, is my past. My past is my greatest asset. And that's all I had to share with her, and I had to trust God. And she got out of the car and went in there, and she chose not to pick up. At 46 years old today, she's never picked up or drank. I don't know if she has the ism or not, but she's never picked up. And I'm very grateful for that. I cried all the way home that day and told Sue, "I don't know what she's going to do, but I have to trust God." And I have many stories in my life about where I had to trust God with my child. And the important thing is that I never put expectations on my daughter. And if I never put expectations on her, I was never disappointed. I wanted to graduate from high school, and I said, "Baby, just try to graduate from high school. I don't care what your grade point is. Just try to graduate from high school." She had a dream. She wanted to be a model, and she she looked beyond where other excuse me. She looked beyond where other people feared to go. And she took a course in modeling, and she got a portfolio. And at about 18, 19 years old, she went to Milan, Italy to be a model. Excuse me. Touches my heart. And we had to let her go. She took her to the airport. She went down there with herself, and she flew halfway around the world. She didn't have know anybody. She didn't know how to talk Italian or anything. And she went over there. She got sick. And she called some people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They came and got her and took her to a meeting. And in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, they asked her to share. And she said, "I'm an Al-Anon, and I know this is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." And they said, "We're not so narrow-minded. If you'll talk program, we'll let you share." She was able to share in that meeting. And sitting in that meeting was a young man named Peter. Now, Peter and I had been on a committee to do something kind of like this together, and he'd lost his billfold. And I was clean-up man, and when I cleaned up, I found his billfold. And I started to steal the money, and I had a newcomer with me, so I had a witness, so I couldn't, you know. And I called him up, and I took the newcomer and my daughter, and I gave him his billfold back, and he got his stuff back. And he said, "Keith, if I really appreciate this. Is there anything I can do for you? Let me know." And years later, several years later, my daughter's halfway around the world in a foreign country. She can't speak Italian. She has no connections with any models or any agents or anything. She's just fulfilling a dream. And she went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and sitting in that meeting was Peter. And when she shared, he said, "Your dad's Keith." And she said, "Yes." He said, "I owe him a favor." He took our daughter. He introduced her to agents. He put her in a place of living where there was other models. He gave her his tapes, and she learned the language. That was 22, 23 years ago. And she was able to stay over there. She was a real pioneer over there in the program, because there were very few meetings of Al-Anon. There was no Alateen. AA didn't have any books, hardly at all, or nobody translated. And she was a pioneer. She started things like this, so to get the people together, she started all kinds of family meetings, Alateen. She translated a lot of literature into Italian for the AA. She's a real pioneer over there. And she's been over there for 22, 23 years. She met a young Italian and got married, and they have two little kids. And Sue and I go over there to see our grandkids, and I go to the in-laws, and they're old Italian, and I go and I ask for an audience, and I tell them, "Thank you for taking care of my little girl as if she were yours." And they say, "Don't worry." And that's all I really want. What could I want more than my kid to be happy? See? And she's got two beautiful little girls, and they call me Pappy, and They've never seen me drunk, and they're not afraid of me. Last year we went over there and we spent time with them, and we stayed in their home, and I watched this young man with my daughter and with his children. I watched him, and he's a good man. He's a good father. He's a good husband. My daughter's a good wife and a good mother. I have nothing to worry about. They're halfway around the world. The most important thing is I have nothing to worry about. They're good people. What more could I want for my child than to be happy? Instead of worrying, are they going to be alcoholic? Are they going to this? The oldest granddaughter, she gets up on her desk and jumps off on the boy's back and beats him up. She can outrun him, outswim him. And the teacher said to my daughter, I don't know. And my daughter, she said, I just couldn't say to the teacher, it's in her DNA, you know. My daughter brought this little baby girl, the first baby, she brought her to America so she could meet her grandparents. My daughter wanted those kids to meet her folks. And they brought this little baby, and we went down to the international airport, and there's people from all over the world, and my daughter came in, and she had this little baby girl, and we're up there yelling, and I'm all tattooed out, and I'm standing up there. I got myself positioned behind, you know, people have the balloons and all the stuff, flowers and everything. I got over by that. So when they came around the corner, this little baby girl looks and sees all these balloons and flowers, and her eyes are sparkling. Grandma's standing there next to me, and I don't know what it's like to be a grandpa. I mean, you know, I'm in here with all the people from all over the world, and my daughter walked up and handed me that little baby. And I looked in her eyes, and she's just sparkling. And I just danced around like an old fool. And then that little girl, and I was happy, and her eyes were just sparkling. She had no reason to fear me. She didn't fear me. She knows not the way I treated her grandma or her mama. She has no reason to fear me. And I choose to believe if I keep doing what I did here this weekend, she'll never have a reason to fear me. You'll never have a reason to fear me. I want to tell you a quick story, and then I'm done. I grew up on a farm, and the story about a farmer and his family. There was this farmer that lived out the edge of town, and there was a country road that went into town. And every time people went to town, they went down that country road. And this farm was a beautiful farmhouse up on a hill and had a big red barn that paralleled the road. And it was Saturday afternoon, this little boy is standing out there with his daddy just looking around, and a big car came down this road, a big black car, whipped right up in the driveway, and this dude got out, and he talked to the farmer. Little boy backed up and watched this man talking to the farmer, and the guy in the car gave the farmer some money, and little boy didn't know what happened, and the guy backed the car down beside this barn. Little boy didn't know what was going on. He was just curious. He walked down there, and this guy opened the trunk, and he gets some stuff out, some rolls of paper and a thing, and starts putting something on the side of that barn, and he rolled his first roll of paper down on the side of that barn. Another roll. In the old days, they had what they called honkers, and Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus would send these honkers out to these towns where the circus was coming, and they put up a big poster, usually on the side of a barn or a building. And it was a beautiful poster. It had all the beautiful people and the animals in the circus and the circus performers and their costumes. Very beautiful, gaudy thing. And this little boy watched this poster evolve on the side of that barn. And he didn't know what it was. And he ran back up there to his daddy and said, Daddy, Daddy, what is that? And the father, being a good father, said, that's a circus, son. And it's going to come to town. If you do your chores and you work hard, I'll let you go see the circus. And every day the little boy would go down and look at that poster, and he just couldn't imagine. I got to see this deal. And he worked hard, and came the day the circus was coming to town. Father, being a good father, he gave the little boy 50 cents. He said, you can go a few miles in there to town and see the circus. The little boy took off, walked all the way to town. As he was coming in the edge of town, in the old days, the Ringling Brothers Circus used to come in on a train, and they'd take it down, put it on a spur, and they'd unload all, they put a tent up over here in a big lot, and all these people get off the train and put on their costumes and get the animals, and then make a parade down through the center of town over to the big top. And that day, the little boy come walking into town. Here was this parade coming down through town, and he sat down on the curb, and there they were, in living, loving, beautiful color, all the live animals he'd never seen before, and the people in their costumes, and he was just in awe. He was watching this parade go by, and the last person in the parade was a clown. When the clown walked by the little boy, he tipped his hat, and the little boy flipped his 50-cent piece up. The clown caught it and went on down the road. The little boy got up and walked back home. When he got home, his daddy said, "Son, did you see the circus?" And the little boy said, "Yes, yes, Daddy, I saw the circus." That's not a happy story. That's not a happy story at all. All he saw was the passing parade. All he saw was the passing parade. Alcoholics Anonymous is a passing parade. I was a sad story when I got here. I don't want to be a sad story. I want in the big top, folks. I want down there in the big top. I want where the action is. I want where the big top is. I want to be in the circus. I want the whole enchilada. I want it all. I don't want to be a sad story. Don't be a sad story. Be a happy story. Come to things like this. Get involved in things like this. Be a part of this celebration and be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Enjoy your life. You may not want what I got, but I hope like heck you keep coming back until you want what you got. God bless and thank you.